You're listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow, episode 20, The First Century. Rome may not have been built in a day, but nevertheless, it rose pretty damn quickly. Rome, of course, began to expand as a republic, conquering the Italian peninsula and Gaul to the west, while gaining a strong military footing in Egypt and the Near East. Remember that it was in 63 BCE, in the dwindling days of the Republic, that Pompey entered Jerusalem. The beginning of the empire, though, began in earnest with the ascension of Augustus in 27 BCE. Yet this aggressive expansion brought challenges. An expanded military had to be sustained and kept happy. The city of Rome itself had to adjust as a teeming, multi-ethnic community, populated with refugees and slaves who flowed in from conquered lands. And most relevantly for us, the Romans had to figure out how to administer this vast empire. In the first century of the Common Era, the Roman system for administering their provinces was still a work in progress. You will remember that after entering Jerusalem, Pompey left. For 27 more years, Judea continued to be ruled by the Hasmonean line, now as Roman clients, but nevertheless recognized as an autonomous kingdom. In 37 or 36 BCE, Herod took the throne. Again, Herod would never have gained and maintained power without Roman backing, but he nevertheless maintained a fair degree of autonomy. Even when he died in 4 BCE, rather than taking direct control of Judea, the Romans attempted to broker a power-sharing arrangement between Herod's sons. In this episode, I turn to the first century CE and the events that led up to the Jewish rebellion against Rome in 66 and the temple's destruction 4 years after that. The argument of this episode is rather straightforward. The Jewish revolt was a result of Roman misadministration, which was in turn largely a result of Roman inexperience in administering a province far from home. This inexperience manifested itself in two ways. First, and generally, the developing Roman system for provincial administration was at its heart colonialist and therefore unstable. Second, and more specifically to the Jews, both in Judea and abroad, the Romans did not understand the sensitivities of their Jewish subjects. What the Romans took as mere trivial superstition, the Jews took far more seriously, and these misunderstandings led to a series of explosive encounters that paved the way for the revolt. So, with the overarching argument on the table, let me return to the narrative. Herod, you will remember, made a big mess out of his family, and it thus came as no surprise that his succession was contested. At his death, Herod designated one of his sons, Archelaus, to succeed him, assuming that Rome would consent. Yet Archelaus immediately faced three challenges. The first was from a group of Jerusalem Jews still upset about his father Herod's treatment of Judas and Matthias, two scholars, as Josephus called them, who encouraged their followers the year before to pull down a large and expensive golden image of an eagle that Herod had erected over the temple, clearly as a tribute to Rome. Herod had them and their followers killed, but now a group called on the new king Archelaus to avenge their deaths. Archelaus advised this group to wait until he was confirmed by Rome, but they pushed the matter during Passover, just as Jerusalem was flooded with pilgrims. Fearing an uprising, Archelaus acted forcefully, killing many and telling other pilgrims to return to their homes. Not a good way to start his reign. The second challenge came from the Roman imperial administrators themselves. The fate of the kingdom was in the hands of the Roman emperor and senate, and Archelaus had to go to Rome to plead his case. Meanwhile, though, as soon as he left, one local Roman administrator, Sabinus, the procurator in Syria, saw an opportunity and moved quickly to take over the fortresses and palaces. Finally, he faced a challenge from one of his brothers, Herod Antipas. Antipas also sailed for Rome, and the two would duke it out before Augustus for the throne. Complicating Augustus's decision was the report of Sabinus about the rich extent of Herod's treasures. There was a lot of gold at stake. And all was not well back in Judea. Sabinus, the procurator, was engaged in a delicate power struggle with his superior, Varus, the governor. Sabinus had tried to outmaneuver the governor as he sought to extend his own power into Judea and Jerusalem, but he overreached. Sabinus's greed brought increasing opposition from the Jews, and he soon found himself besieged by a mass of Jews in Jerusalem. Sabinus's position was so dire that he had to send to Varus for help. Varus put down the revolt and quashed Sabinus's aspirations, but all at great loss of life. Judea had just undergone its first small revolt against Rome. This revolt and the Jewish pleas to Augustus to end the Herodian line completely did not help Archelaus's case. Augustus ultimately decided to appoint Archelaus as ethnarch rather than king, but sheared off parts of Judea to give to Herod's other sons, Herod Antipas and Philip, to rule. Archelaus did nothing to further Augustus's trust in him, and after numerous complaints, the Romans banished Archelaus to Gaul in 6 CE, placing his territory, including Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and Samaria, under direct Roman rule, now as part of the province of Syria. Philip managed to hold on to his territories until 33-34 CE, and Herod Antipas, the famous one now, who is mentioned in the Gospels, ruled the Galilee until 39 CE. From the year 6 CE to 66, then, Judea and Jerusalem fell directly under Roman rule to a greater or lesser degree, as we will see. The administrative arrangement the Romans imposed, though, was anomalous and continued to some degree the previous arrangement. Judea was a separate administrative entity at whose head was a prefect or procurator of the equestrian rank, yet who was also subordinate to the governor or legate of Syria. The prefect or procurator, the sources use the term interchangeably, and in truth there was little practical difference between these two designations, tended to live in Caesarea. Here a little background might be helpful. The Romans organized most of their ever-expanding empire as provinces like Syria, under the rule of a governor or legate who had a senatorial rank. A few areas like Judea, though, were ruled by equestrian prefects. The equestrian class was comprised of rich Romans, second in rank to the senators. While the class originated within the Roman army during the period of the Republic, and despite Augustus's attempt to reconnect the rank to military service, by the first century it had little connection to its origins. These equestrians frequently served necessary bureaucratic functions in the imperial administration. They were additionally useful because since they lacked senatorial rank, they were less threatening to the emperor. Serving in the provinces was often a path to even greater wealth for them. Shuttled from one administrative district to another, they were given a great deal of latitude for skimming as much personal profit as they could from the area under their charge. So long as Rome collected her share of the revenue, and the district did not rebel or show other signs of discontent, the prefect could more or less take what he wanted. There was no reward other than profit, no upward mobility that would reward or define good governance outside of increasing revenues while keeping the peace. A Roman prefect, such as the one installed in Judea, had three primary functions. The first was the collection of taxes. This is why, as soon as Copinus, the first procurator of Judea, arrived, Rome also sent a legate, Quirinius, to conduct a census. This census immediately irritated the Jewish inhabitants. Josephus tells us that two Jews, Judas and Sadoc, the latter, interestingly, identified as a Pharisee, crystallized the opposition to the census in ideological terms. They said, Josephus tells us, that the assessment carried with it a status amounting to downright slavery, no less an appeal to the nation to make a bid for independence. Josephus refers to this ideology as the fourth philosophy, on top of those of the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes. Most Judeans, though, were not as ideological or naive. They opposed the census because they knew it meant increasing taxes, but that was not enough to bring them to open opposition to Rome. It was through the census that Rome determined its share of poll tax revenues. A procurator like Copinus would have had private concerns bid for the right to collect these taxes. These tax farmers, publicani, would pay the Romans for the right to collect these taxes from a given district. And then they, too, were entitled to skim what they could. The gravy train went all the way down, while keeping the Roman authorities at arm's length from the actual collection of taxes. This was a true and tested way to deal with taxation in the ancient world, one that we saw already in the early Hellenistic period. Rome did not rule by love, but nor did it try to rule through force. The threat of force was far more effective and cheaper. The Roman military contained legions and auxiliaries. The legions were composed of the more serious professional troops. Auxiliaries were largely made of locals, more lightly armed and not as well trained. The procurator of Judea had no legions under his control. The nearest legions in the area were under the command of the legate of Syria. The procurator instead had auxiliaries. There were most likely few, if any, Jews among these troops. According to Josephus, because of the various conflicts that Jews would encounter as troops, especially working on the Sabbath and holidays, from the time of Julius Caesar, the Romans exempted them from military service. The auxiliary troops in Judea were not particularly harsh or hostile toward the Jewish residents, but they were, as we shall see, insensitive, which in this case had disastrous consequences. In addition to financial and military functions, the procurator also had judicial authority. In his hands alone was the power to administer capital punishment. He also had to coordinate the administration of Roman courts throughout the province. We do not have a lot of information about the court system. Presumably, there was some option for Roman citizens to receive justice under Roman law, and they may well have had the option to argue their cases before the governor himself. The courts administering Roman law, though, were probably few and far between, located in only a few of the larger urban centers. Most cities would have administered their own court system that would have handled the bulk of civil matters. The cities were in turn largely free to govern themselves, led by local aristocratic and wealthy families. This background helps to shed at least a little light on the role and function of the Sanhedrin. The New Testament Gospels, written again after the destruction of Jerusalem, portray the Sanhedrin in Jerusalem primarily as a judicial body. Rabbinic writings composed another century or so later provides a fuller and more robust image of the Sanhedrin, describing its administration by sages and its extensive national legislative powers. Unfortunately, that portrayal appears largely to have been an anachronistic fantasy. The Sanhedrin might have distant origins in the chief men or elders in Jerusalem in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah. As long as Jews maintained some degree of autonomy in Jerusalem, they needed governance. There is some evidence to suggest that this governance would have been shared or negotiated between wealthy and aristocratic families and prominent priests, especially the high priest. This power-sharing arrangement then crystallized into some kind of city council, whose scope of authority was, of course, limited by the Persian authorities. The council's authority, a bit ironically, would then have been further limited on the ascension of the Hasmonean monarchs, who as high priests would themselves have served as head of the council. As we all know, councils or committees are funny things, often moving in unanticipated directions. As the Hasmonean line was coming to an end, With its last weak rulers, the power of this council moved to grab for more authority. At the beginning of Roman rule, the territory was divided into districts, or Sanhedria in Greek. One of them was Jerusalem. It is only now that the term Sanhedrin, or in Greek Synedrion, appears for the first time in Josephus. Josephus tells us that while Hyrcanus II was ethnarch, around 47 BCE, the Sanhedrin summoned Herod to answer for his actions in the Galilee. It would appear then that at this time the Galilee fell into the district run out of Jerusalem. If the Sanhedrin saw a window of opportunity to expand its powers, Herod quickly closed it. Upon his ascension, he, for all practical intents, suspended the Sanhedrin. Under Herod's much weaker son, Archelaus, the Sanhedrin emerged again, this time with a much reduced geographical sphere of authority. Remember that Archelaus had power only in Judea. Also, it would appear that while priests and non-priestly aristocrats shared power on the Sanhedrin, the priests, and especially the high priest himself, had the upper hand, yet the Sanhedrin would remain secondary to the monarch. In 6 CE, though, with the banishment of Archelaus, another opportunity opened. The Sanhedrin would continue to have authority only in Judea proper, but the new Roman procurators would have been happy to allow the council to expand its administrative functions, as long as the revenues continued to flow and there were no serious disturbances. The internal conflicts and power struggles in the Sanhedrin were of little consequence to the Roman authorities. Roman authorities, of course, retained the right to administer capital punishment and to make other really important decisions. So let's pause for a moment and take stock. Roman procurators, who often knew nothing about the Jews or their region, and whose primary motivation was personal gain, ran Judea from the coastal city of Caesarea. They were relatively hands-off. They had no policy of political oppression or cultural imperialism. And indeed, it is somewhat amazing to the extent to which Latin never really penetrated into the region. The local Judeans continued to use Greek and Aramaic. Romans projected their power in the form of auxiliary troops, stationed thinly in garrisons throughout the district. In the meantime, the most important Jewish city in the province was Jerusalem, far from the seat of imperial representatives. Here the Sanhedrin, under the direction of the high priests, stepped up to assert its authority. This would have provoked two related power struggles. One was between the Sanhedrin and the aristocratic families, who would have effectively been disenfranchised. They still had money and reputation, but no institutional base of power. The second was within the Sanhedrin itself, where various factions of Jews, such as priests, Pharisees, and Sadducees, vied for power. In normal times, such squabbles over power would be entirely expected and not very consequential. But these were not normal times. A series of Roman missteps in Jerusalem throughout the first century ultimately transformed these internal power struggles into open revolt. The first two decades of Roman rule appears to have gone smoothly enough. The first misstep was by Pontius Pilate, the procurator from 26 to 36. At the very beginning of his reign, Josephus tells us, Pilate moved his army to his winter quarters in Jerusalem. The army brought with them busts of the emperor. It is unclear whether Pilate was being an insensitive bore or deliberately provocative. Since he brought the images in at night, and previous procurators knew not to do anything like this, I suspect the latter. Jews immediately began to protest. A large crowd gathered outside of Pilate's palace in Caesarea, where he had remained. After a week of protests, Pilate staged a showdown, surrounding the crowd with Roman troops and threatened to kill them if they did not disband. Josephus records a massive show of passive resistance as the Jews asserted their willingness to die over this issue. Pilate backed down. But he was not done. Perhaps stung by his defeat, he took money from the Jewish temple to build an aqueduct. Again the Jews protested, but this time Pilate was ready. Without warning, he sent in troops in disguise to beat the protesters. It is at this point in his narrative that Josephus tells us about Jesus. The chronology would accord with Pilate's execution of him, around 30 CE. As told by the New Testament, the Jewish authorities encouraged Pilate to put Jesus to death. The exact events are unclear, but it is worth noting that whatever happened, it was playing out at a time of volatile relations between Pilate and the residents, and presumably Jewish authorities of Jerusalem. Assuming even the limited accuracy of the accounts in the Gospels, Jesus' death took place within, and could have been influenced by, this larger political context. The Sanhedrin, for example, might have wanted to assert its power to make a point to Pilate. Or conversely, perhaps it was Pilate who wanted to emphasize that decisions of life and death were in his hands alone. Pilate was procurator of Judea for a decade, which is a relatively long period of service for a procurator in one place. Yet he hardly learned. The end of his term was as controversial as the beginning. Pilate sent the army to interfere with a disturbance in Samaria, and the resulting deaths were so out of proportion that the governor of Syria, now Vitellius, sent Pilate back to Rome. And for about 2 years there was relative calm. Vitellius was well enough liked by the Jews of Jerusalem, especially when he reduced their taxes. Herod's son Philip, who had ruled the southern area of Palestine well, had died in 33-34 CE, and his territory was under direct but mild Roman administration. Whatever hope the Jews had for continued calm came to a crashing halt with the ascension of Gaius Caligula to the Roman throne in 38 CE. Shortly after his ascension, Caligula gave Philip's former territory to Agrippa, a descendant of the Hasmoneans who was in Rome at the time. On his way back to his new territory, Agrippa stopped in Alexandria. Now, the situation in Alexandria between the Jews and the Greeks was tense to begin with. The Jews had recently asserted their rights to citizenship in the polis, which the Greeks rejected. Agrippa's visit came at a bad time and triggered riots between the Jews and the Greeks. Both sides sent delegations to Caligula. Interestingly, the Jewish delegation included the philosopher Philo, and one Greek delegate was Apion, the same who wrote the tract against the Jews, to which Josephus responded. The Jews were accused of not honoring Caligula properly, for they did not erect altars and statues in his honor. Caligula, it turns out, was stunned to hear this. To test this charge, he commanded the new governor of Syria, Petronius, to set up his statue in the Jerusalem temple. Petronius marched on Jerusalem well equipped. In addition to auxiliaries, he took two Roman legions, prepared to subdue any armed Jewish resistance. What he was not prepared for, though, was the same passive resistance that Pilate confronted, over more or less the same issue. Jewish delegations met Petronius on his way to Jerusalem and convinced him that they would all rather die than allow images to be set up in the temple. On no account would we fight, they said, but we will die sooner than violate our laws. Petronius decided to ask Caligula how we should proceed. Even Agrippa, who by this time had been given the territory of the Galilee that had been ruled by Herod Antipas, begged Caligula to desist. While swayed by Agrippa's appeal, Caligula was furious at what he took to be Petronius's dithering and insubordination. Petronius was saved only by Caligula's death in 41 CE. If the Jews both in Judea and Alexandria were big winners with the death of Caligula and the ascension of Claudius, it was Agrippa who got the brass ring. Claudius conferred on him the rule over Judea as well. His kingdom was thus equivalent to Herod's. And once again, there was hope for calm. By all accounts, Agrippa appears to have been a good ruler. He kept good relations with Rome and appears to have been well liked by the Jews. Both Josephus and the rabbis remember him as devout, although that did not stop him from participating in the festive games in honor of the emperor in Caesarea. It was there in 44 CE, after only ruling his United Kingdom for 3 years, that he suddenly died. The entire district formerly under Agrippa's reign was now placed under direct Roman administration, where it would remain until the revolt of 66. The first two procurators were not bad. The second was Tiberius Julius Alexander, Philo's nephew, who served from around 46 CE to 48. Things began to get much worse under his successor, a man named Cumanus. Under his rule, from 48 to 52 CE, two insensitive acts on the part of Roman soldiers provoked Jewish riots. The first took place during Passover, when a Roman soldier exposed himself to the Jews by the porticos of the temple. Thousands lost their lives in the ensuing disturbance. Soon after, while chasing some brigands, a Roman soldier ripped up a scroll of the Torah publicly, thus provoking Jewish outrage. This riot, unlike the first, Cumanus quickly calmed by executing the soldier. More serious was a disturbance between Jews and Samaritans that Cumanus handled poorly, thus resulting in widespread violence and Cumanus's own banishment. Felix, the procurator from 52 to 60, succeeded Cumanus, and as Josephus says, in Judea matters were constantly going from bad to worse. Felix's inept administrative abilities came even to the attention of the Roman historian Tacitus, who said that Felix ruled with the spirit of a slave. He put many to death and was utterly rapacious. Brigands increased, and there was a major civic disturbance in Caesarea. By now, there had arisen a serious Jewish rebel group in Judea, known as the Sicarii, for their knives, which they used to commit political assassinations. Felix was recalled by Nero in 60 CE, and his successor, Festus, had a mess on his hands. Josephus tells us that he acted against the Sicarii and other brigands, but he was not terribly successful. He died in 62 CE. Two more procurators, Albinus and Florus, followed, and they were far worse than Festus. How bad was it? Josephus says, "So wicked and lawless was Florus in the exercise of his authority, that the Jews, owing to the extremity of their misery, raised Albinus as a benefactor." The country was on the verge of open rebellion. Over the 60 years from the death of Archelaus in 6 to the revolt of 66, inept Roman administration combined with religious insensitivity to transform a more or less stable, loyal Roman province into one filled with widespread brigandage and internal power struggles, united only by popular hatred of Rome. Mid-level Jewish nobles, increasingly impoverished and disenfranchised, grew desperate and perhaps emboldened by Agrippa's successful reign. The breakdown of social order caused a power vacuum that the Sanhedrin and other Jewish groups, such as the Pharisees and Sadducees, tried to fill. Politically limited, these groups and those of the Essenes, the community at Qumran, the early followers of Jesus, and the countless prophets roaming the countryside, all asserted power in a different sphere. It was a kind of religious response to colonization. There would be a political and a military response too, of course. We turn to that in the next episode. You have been listening to the podcast From Israelite to Jew with Michael Sadlow. The original score is by Neil Ginsberg, with vocals by Michelle Tatenbaum. Technical assistance was provided by the Language Resource Center and the Instructional Technology Group, both at Brown University. More information can be found at msatlow.blogspot.com or at mlsatlow.com on the public education page. I welcome your comments. Thank you for listening.